This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We appreciate you joining us for Trumpet Hour as we get ready to discuss the important events of this past week with our panel of trumpet writers. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
We also have Anthony Chibatterwe.
Hello.
And from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
Of all the news that we could talk about, the one that really trumps every other story is the fact that observers are recognizing we are closer to nuclear Armageddon than at any time in the last six decades. Most dramatically, the minute hand of the symbolic doomsday clock was moved forward by 30 seconds yesterday, and it brings the time to just 2 minutes to midnight. This is the symbolic hour of global nuclear destruction. But this observation made by those atomic scientists, those have been backed up by others that are making similar statements about the dangers facing our world today. Richard Palmer talked about this in some depth on this morning's Trumpet Daily Radio Show, an excellent program. I'd encourage you to go and listen to that. On the program today, we're going to hear about this from Jeremiah.
Yes, as you said, the minute hand was brought forward by 30 seconds, and so that brings the time to 2 minutes until midnight. And as you said there, the midnight, of course, symbolizes global nuclear destruction. This clock was created back in 1947, just after nuclear weapons had been developed and used for the first time. And it's just a symbolic measurement of the likelihood that mankind will begin nuclear war. So the farthest from midnight that the clock has ever stood was back in 1991. That was when the Cold War ended, and it was set back to 17 minutes to midnight. And then the nearest to 0 hour that it's ever been, at least before this week, was back in 1953. And at that time, it sat at 2 minutes to midnight. And that move at that time came as a result of an announcement that both the U.S. and the Soviet Union had both tested thermonuclear devices. So that was the closest it ever was to midnight. And now the clock is once again at 11:58 for only the second time in its 70-year history. So these scientists are just very concerned, even alarmed, about how close the world is to a nuclear World War III.
So tell us about who it is that is making this determination and then some of the rationale that they used as they're looking at events in the world that led them to this conclusion.
Sure, yes. Well, it's a panel of experts. They're scientists, geopolitics experts, they're global security experts and physicists as well. They have, I believe, 15 Nobel laureates. So they're just different experts in various fields who take a look at risks. And so the main reason why they made this decision to move the clock forward this year was because of an increase in risks in the nuclear realm. North Korea was the main country that they pointed to. One quote from their press release says, quote, "North Korea now has or soon will have capabilities to match its verbal threats, specifically a thermonuclear warhead and a ballistic missile that can carry it to the U.S. mainland." And then the report says Pyongyang's nuclear progress increases risks to North Korea itself, to other countries in the region, and to the United States. So North Korea was the highest country on the list, but they also mentioned Russia, which recently violated the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. We talked about that on a Trumpet Hour a few months back. And then the Doomsday Clock scientists also pointed to China, where, quote, "tensions over the South China Sea have increased and where relations between the United States and China have been insufficient to reestablish a stable security situation." Then they also pointed to Pakistan and India, saying that they are building ever larger arsenals of nuclear weapons. And finally, they pointed to Iran's nuclear activities and the uncertainty about the nuclear deal between Iran and the U.S. and other world powers.
A pretty clear-minded assessment. All of those places, all of the threats that they were pointing to, definitely exactly what we're looking at as we're watching events unfold according to biblical prophecy. They're looking at it obviously from a different standpoint, but coming to the same conclusion.
Yeah, that's right. And then they said that another big reason why we're now closer to midnight or closer to a nuclear world war is because of a breakdown in the international order. They said the United States has increasingly backed away from its long-standing leadership role in the world, and now neither allies nor adversaries have been able to reliably predict U.S. actions. So the U.S. is retreating, and they say that that adds quite a bit to the likelihood of an outbreak of nuclear war.
Richard, this morning when you were going through this on the program, obviously we have this batch of experts who are making this determination, but you just brought out a couple of pretty eye-popping headlines from elsewhere in the press and individuals who are essentially coming to the same conclusion. Maybe you could just give a little bit of an overview of what you covered and what some of those headlines are.
Right. So these are both just from yesterday, and they're completely independent to the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. I think both these articles were published before that. But one came from Stratfor, and it was called The New Nuclear Age, A Journey into the Unknown. And, you know, Stratfor, well, both of these. The other one was from The Economist. And these are two well-respected, you know, in-depth news analysis organizations. They generally employ academics. You know, they're not ones given to hyperbole. Mm-hmm. They, you know, that you don't see dramatic headlines in these publications all that often. But they both had these very remarkable stories. So this Stratfor one, for example, talked about, it said the continent could soon become a more dangerous place than it was even in 1914. And it basically talked about how it went through why we've not had a nuclear war so far and talked about how all of those conditions are changing. And suddenly this is much more of a possibility. And then The Economist, theirs was called The Growing Danger of Great Power Conflict, The Next War. And they talked about, again, how the future of war could be closer than you think, they said in the conclusion of their article. And just like Jeremiah said, one of the key things that stood out from both of these is they both pointed to the decline in the U.S. and the declining power of the U.S. And they're saying, I mean, The Economist especially drew the comparison to the decline of Britain and said, well, Germany then challenged that in World War One. It looks like we're heading for a similar situation, the decline of America. And so now other nations feel that it's possible for them to challenge. And so they're going to do so. So really sobering warnings from these publications that don't normally talk in these terms.
Richard was on fire this morning. I really would encourage you to go and listen to that program. But one of the points that he makes very strongly in there is just how much human nature wants to put this kind of news off and to fall asleep. He had a couple of really good quotes from Herbert W. Armstrong on that subject and just how easy it is to be complacent about this type of thing. But it really is important to see just the threat as it's being recognized by some of these experts. Maybe you could just put this into prophetic context for us, Jeremiah, just why it is that we are so concerned about this when we look at this from the standpoint of what the Bible says.
Sure, yes. This doomsday clock is just a symbol, but it has been on the radar of Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury since at least 2002. At that time, the clock was moved forward from 9 minutes to midnight up to 7 minutes till midnight. And Mr. Fleury wrote, quote, "The world should have jolted out of sleep at the news, but no real alarm was sounded. The majority of news media dismissed it, and many still slumber on as the world heads toward self-destruction." That was an article that Mr. Fleury wrote in the May 2002 Philadelphia Trumpet. And he goes on to explain that really the reason why that move was so significant is because of what Bible prophecy says about a nuclear World War III. So he quotes Matthew 24, verses 21 through 22, which say, "There shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened." So this scripture is describing a global war that could end all human life. And that couldn't really have happened before the nuclear age. And so, you know, mankind just didn't have the weaponry before nuclear weapons were developed that could have wiped out all people. So that really dates that prophecy in a powerful way. And after Mr. Fleury quoted that Bible passage, he wrote, quote, "Jesus Christ was talking about a time when the annihilation of all human life would be possible. This has everything to do with the doomsday clock," end quote. And then from there, he just explained that although the setting of the doomsday clock, you know, although moving that forward does point to some dark times in the near term, that it also indicates the most hope-filled event in mankind's history and that that event is very near. He said, quote, 7 minutes to nuclear annihilation really means 7 minutes to the greatest possible news you could ever hear. It's all a sign that Jesus Christ is about to return to stop mankind from destroying himself and to show the world how to have peace, happiness, and joy. So Mr. Fleury wrote all that when the clock was at 7 minutes to midnight. So I think that all the urgency and excitement about this is even more intense now that this clock stands at 2 minutes to midnight.
And for more information, it really seems like we have a booklet that speaks to this subject absolutely directly. Tell us about that.
Yes, Mr. Fleury's written a very powerful new booklet called Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door, and we'll have a link to that in our show notes. It really goes in depth with that Matthew 24 prophecy and numerous other Bible passages. And so we'll be sure to have a link to that in the show notes.
Thank you very much, Jeremiah. Well, this past weekend, Turkey launched a military incursion into northwestern Syria. We've been following the complicated relationships between the countries that are involved in this quagmire in Syria. And this movement by Turkey reveals more of what's going on between Turkey, Russia, the United States, and other nations. For this story, we're going to turn to Anthony Chibadewe.
What's happening in Syria has to be probably the most complicated development of the past 7 years. And it has been probably the most disastrous development in the past 7 years, because this is a civil war, an ongoing civil war, the result of the Arab Spring that began in 2011. So it's been going on for almost 7 years now, and nations have tried the best they could to try to resolve it, particularly the United States, and it has failed dismally. And its influence in Syria has been diminished over the years. And the fate of Syria in the last few months has been placed in the hands of Iran, Russia, and Turkey. And that's not a very good combination, not only because these are rogue nations, but also because these three nations allied together to try to resolve the conflict in Syria. And yet they had their own agendas. They had different interests. Turkey, for example, is right on the border with Syria, and Turkey is very concerned about what it considered terrorism coming from Syria. So its interest in this region has been to create a buffer, a security buffer in Syria, so that those terrorists do not reach into Turkey, and also so that there aren't any refugees streaming into Turkey. So this latest offensive, Operation Olive Branch, it began on January 20th, and it began primarily because 6 days earlier, the United States had announced that it's going to start supporting a force about 30,000 Kurdish fighters on the border with Turkey, on Syria's border with Turkey. And of course, Turkey is not very excited about the Kurds. It considers a lot of them to be terrorists. So it does not support what the United States is doing. And Turkish president angrily announced that we're not going to have any of this. In fact, he threatened that our mission is to strangle this force even before it's born. And that's why Turkey launched the operation in northwestern Syria.
That right there is a very strong point about this, the fact that Erdogan was just so quick and strong in countering the move that America made. I mean, you're talking about a pretty significant rift between two major NATO allies.
And because the future of Syria has been entrusted into Turkey and the other countries like Iran and Russia, the United States feels like it has to accommodate Turkey's concerns to a degree. So that just adds to the complications in Syria. How do you solve it? America doesn't have an influence in there, at least not as much as Turkey now does. So whatever Turkey demands, the United States will have to try to just go along or just try to ignore it, because this is a big deal. This is a big clash between NATO allies. And events of the past week have proved that Turkey is just willing to go it alone, really. It went in with a force of about 40,000 troops and going after about 10,000 Kurdish fighters. But to get into this region, Turkey needed air support from Russia, because Russia does control that airspace. And Russia has been reluctant to allow Turkey to continue this operation, but it actually did allow Turkey to move in. Even though they have somewhat different interests there, the Russians agreed, and some analysts have said that Russia's main reason for agreeing to support Turkey is because they want to further divide the United States and Turkey. Yet another big problem that we find in this development.
So it definitely shows America's loss of influence. And it definitely, like so many of the cases that we look at, when we see the way that Russia leverages its power, it gets a lot of... in this situation, it seems like it really did not necessarily want Turkey to do this, but it viewed pleasing Turkey and giving Turkey this open door into this portion of Syria as... less of a problem, and the advantage that it would gain over America would trump the cost.
Like I said at the beginning, what's happening in Syria is so complicated with all these different powers with different interests. Turkey, by the way, does not want Assad to continue ruling in Syria. If he cannot remove Assad, it wants to diminish his influence. And we know that Assad's biggest ally is Iran. So Turkey is, in a way, fighting against Assad and Iran indirectly. It wants the so-called moderate rebels to increase their power and their influence in some parts of Syria. And it wants to diminish the power of Assad. So already we are seeing fractures in this alliance between Turkey, Iran, and Russia. And what Turkey is doing right now seems like it's going to empower some of the rebels and undermine Assad and, by extension, Iran.
Well, I'd like to go ahead and move into our next story, which is very closely related to this. For more information on this specifically, you can go on to thetrumpet.com. Anthony's written a story there that's up. That's titled "Turkey Launches Operation Olive Branch in Syria." Puts this in a little more prophetic context, but I'd like to just discuss the fact that when Turkey made this incursion, it used German tanks, and it did so in violation of agreements with NATO. This really put the spotlight on this relationship between Germany and Turkey in a way. I think it's probably one of the most significant takeaways from what happened here, a very prophetically significant relationship between Germany and Turkey. So let's go ahead and transition for this segment to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes. So when they invaded Syria, they did so using these German Leopard 2 tanks. And this is something they've used extensively in various conflicts. So just over a year ago, they were using these same tanks and operations against the Kurds. As you said, Germany, when they sold these tanks to Syria, they were in the contract, they were only to be used in NATO operations. But Germany's continued to tolerate Turkey using them in this way. They even sent them spare parts after they used them against the Kurds last year. So you've got Turkey going into Syria backed in a very symbolic way by Germany, using these German weapons. And what this has really shed the spotlight in is there is a really growing relationship, especially when it comes to military and arms, between Germany and Turkey. And the tanks that were used this time, in some ways, are just the tip of the iceberg. So, for example, we've talked on this show a few times about this building rapprochement between Germany and Turkey. They fell out last year. They're drawing closer together. One of the big things Turkey wants is they want Germany to upgrade their Leopard 2 tanks. When they went into Syria before, about a year ago, they found that they were vulnerable in certain places to improvised explosive devices, this kind of thing. So they want Germany to put in a to modernize them, to put in all of the latest armor, some of the latest weapons, this kind of thing. That's a big contract. And this is one of the big things that they've been talking about in their meetings with Germany. And then even that, that's well, German foreign policy, they wrote this week that this upgrade is considered momentous, not only because it significantly increases the future scope of the Turkish army in operations such as the current one in Syria. The modernization of the Leopard 2A4 is also considered by observers to be a preparation for a much more important project, Rheinmetall's involvement in the construction of a tank factory in Turkey. So Turkey wants to start making their own tanks. They have their state manufacturing company, BMC. They've bought a site already, but they have no experience making tanks. On the other hand, Germany manufactures what is considered by a lot of experts to be the greatest tank of its generation. And so they want to partner with Rheinmetall and develop this project together. Rheinmetall have already set up a Turkish subsidiary to prepare for this. And this is a big project. Turkey's looking at making 1,000 of these tanks. The United Arab Emirates has already said they might be interested in buying 1,000 of these tanks. It's great in a lot of ways for Rheinmetall because Germany has strict limits on exporting and what weapons it can export. And it's politically, it's kind of difficult, and it creates a, the German public don't really like this idea of German weapons being used in conflict zones. So it creates headlines every time they try and sell everywhere. By building a factory in Turkey, they get around a whole load of that. And so it'd be easier for them to use these weapons. So you've already got Turkey armed by Germany, and there are substantial other arms contracts, and Turkey's building German guns under license, for example. Now you're looking at just bringing that to a whole nother level, and really Turkey being this outlet for German weapons to spread across the whole of the Middle East, or even more so across the Middle East.
It's amazing to me that we're having this conversation when I just think I can't help but reflect back on the conversation that we were having a year ago. In the wake of that that coup in Turkey, and just how much that jeopardized the relationship between Germany and Turkey, all of the diplomatic fallout between those two countries, and just how much tension there was in that relationship. You're talking about a very deep level of collusion between Germany and Turkey, and a certain amount of business as usual, in spite of what you see happening from Erdogan. Anthony made this point in his article as well about just how much we see Erdogan's power growing. Russia going ahead and giving into what Erdogan wanted, allowing him to make this incursion into Syria. You see Germany making these accommodations, and I don't imagine that we're going to see any real consequences for Germany or for Turkey violating their agreement with NATO and using these tanks in this way. Turkey's really, in some ways, it's in a fairly good position here with respect to its relations with these other nations.
It's in a good position, literally. I mean, it's at the crossroads between Europe and the Middle East. And if you're a Middle Eastern power with ambitions to, or a European power with ambitions to project power into the Middle East, Turkey, it has been throughout history, and it still is one of the best partners that you could have to work for.
Well, let's just focus on this, the point that you were making about the fact that you would have German arms spreading via Turkey to all of these other Middle Eastern nations. There was actually this news that came out about the weapons exports that this German government has been involved in, and just how much the Middle East has been some of the biggest customers. Tell us about that.
That's right. So this last previous government over the last 4 years or so, they approved more weapons exports than any other post-war government in German history. And this is a government that even the SDP went into that government saying, we want to crack down on arms exports. We want to reduce arms exports. We're going to really insist on that as part of the governing member. And it breaks these records. More than that, though, it also breaks records when it comes to exporting outside of NATO, because typically Germany sells vast majority to its weapons to the EU and NATO. Whereas this time around, around half went to outside of the EU and NATO. And it was the Middle East that was right at the top of who got those weapons. It was Algeria was one of the top destinations, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Egypt. they were at the top of Germany's export list. So you're seeing Germany already arming the Middle East in this way and using arms to build an alliance of these Middle Eastern countries. You know, these are all anti-Iranian countries. These are all countries, you know, on that side of the fence, at least, you know, for now. You know, we've talked before about how nations like Egypt will not stay in that position, but they're seeking to bolster countries that are independent of Iran using these weapons exports. They even called it the Merkel Doctrine before, because this was so common. I think it became unpopular, so they've dialed back, say, the publicity related to it. But you've just seen that go on stronger than ever in this last 4 years of Germany's government.
So as I'd like to return to Anthony here, just as complicated as that situation is in Syria and with Turkey, we do have a prophecy that gives quite a bit of clarity to what is most significant here. Why don't you tell us about that, Anthony?
The prophecy is found in Psalm 83, and it talks about an alliance of nations. Some of those nations include Germany and Turkey and a host of Arab nations. Already some of those Arab nations are already aligned together, and now we're seeing you're seeing the Turkey angle, you're seeing more of the German angle, that connection. And these nations are prophesied to come together politically and militarily with the purpose to undermine the United States and Britain and the nation of Israel in the Middle East. So this is a development toward the fulfillment of that prophecy.
You can read all about that alliance prophesied in Psalm 83 in our booklet, The King of the South. There's a chapter in there called A Mystery Alliance, or a section in that booklet that specifically describes that and the nations that are going to be allied in that. So go check that out at thetrumpet.com. Thank you, Anthony. Thank you, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We've got one more story here before we take a quick break. A stunning report in the Jerusalem Post this week about a recent meeting between John Kerry, who was U.S. Secretary of State during the Obama administration, and a man close to Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas, that reveals just how far some folks on the left are willing to go to undermine the current U.S. president. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, well, I probably shouldn't be as shocked at this story as I was. But I guess this recapping details is that it's well known that President Trump recognized Jerusalem as the eternal capital of Israel on December 6th. The Palestinians were pretty upset by that and said they were freezing negotiations and the peace process with the United States. And now it's turned out that apparently they're not actually freezing negotiations with everyone in the United States, but just the Trump administration and the U.S. government. Because according to reports this week, at some time over the past few weeks, John Kerry, who was Secretary of State under former President Barack Obama, but holds no government position now, went to London and met with Hussein Agha, who's a close associate for the Palestinian Authority President, Mahmoud Abbas, to discuss the Jerusalem issue. And the reports are is that he told him to hold on and be strong, that he should stay strong in his spirit and play for time, that he will not break and not yield to President Donald Trump's demands. And then he, I don't know how he knows these things, but he indicated that he thinks President Trump probably won't be in office for much longer than a year. And even if he is, he personally is considering running against him in the 2020 election.
This would be a few go-rounds for him.
Yes, we would be. He didn't do so well in the 2004 election against George W. Bush. And then he went even a little further than that, saying that he's even now offering to create an alternative peace initiative and promise to help garner international support from the Europeans and from Arab states and from the international community.
So what does this tell you about the state of politics in the United States today, but maybe more broadly why this would be significant, that we would have a Palestinian leader who's being offered this kind of a package or this kind of deal from someone the likes of John Kerry.
Right. Well, as far as U.S. politics, it just does show a lot of the gridlock and division and ideological struggle that the nation's in. And it's not an exaggeration to say that the nation is actually kind of already in a civil war, and not a violent civil war, but at least an ideological civil war, where you have the two political parties who are so against each other, or in this case, I guess it's more that the Democratic Party is so against the Trump administration, so against the Republican Party, that they're actually willing to sabotage their efforts on the world scene and even support rival nations over their own nation, which is tremendously significant for internal politics in the U.S. But for as far as politics in the Middle East are concerned, I mean, you've got to look at this kind of like the Israelis must be looking at this, as they were really excited that the U.S. government's now recognizing Jerusalem as its capital. But then they're hearing these reports that maybe Trump's going to be out of office in a year, or maybe there's going to be people running against him who's going to undo everything, or that there's people even now negotiating with other international partners. To undermine the peace deals that the Trump administration is going to. And you've got to think, for those Israeli policymakers, no matter how well-meaning they believe the Trump administration or President Trump to be, the U.S. is an unreliable ally for them, just in the fact that it's struggling with so much domestic division and is swinging back and forth wildly between the Obama administration, who was helping the Palestinians undermine the Jewish state, to the Trump administration, who's supporting the Jewish state, and then they're trying to figure out where's this going to go in the next couple years. And that really brings us to a very key prophecy we've watched for a while. I brought a section with me from our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury's booklet, Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet, where he writes that Hosea 5, verses 4 through 5, reveals that America, Britain, and the Jewish state will fall together. But notice, it refers to them as Israel, Ephraim, and Judah. The one called Israel here is Manasseh. And why would God call Manasseh Israel? I think it's because it is the superpower. At time, God allows Manasseh to represent the House of Israel, the U.S. and Britain, because of its superpower status. Verse 13 says, when Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah saw his wound, they went to the Assyrian, to King Jareb, yet he could not heal you nor cure you of your wound. No one can cure or heal them of those. Only God can do that. All right, and this is the really significant part here. He says, in that prophecy, Judah and Ephraim don't go to the U.S. for help. I'm sure by that point the U.S. will have already collapsed. I suppose there is a possibility that the U.S. could refuse to help. Already under this administration, it hasn't been helping Ephraim and Judah much. And so this prophecy just shows that Judah's, the Jewish nation in Israel, is going to realize that this peace process is a deadly wound to them, and they're going to need help. They're going to go to Assyria or Germany for that help, because their relationship with the United States, something isn't right about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, it may be that the U.S. is hostile at that time, but as he mentioned there, it's more likely that they've just collapsed, and you've kind of already in some ways seen that collapse unfolding with just this gridlock, to where you can't actually trust either political party to have a position of strength to offer anything in these peace deals, because they have more problems being undermined by their political rival than they have with Palestinians or whoever else.
Yeah. Yeah, Stephen Fleury talked about this as well on an earlier program this week on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. You can go check that out at thetrumpet.com and look under the Trumpet Daily Radio Show Hub. We appreciate that, Andrew. It's a phenomenal story to see that taking place. Very, very unusual. but that is the state that the United States finds itself in today. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about what's happening at the economic summit in Davos, China pushing to make a move to swallow Taiwan, unrest in Ethiopia, and why the poorest state in America is California. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
The World Economic Forum is meeting in Davos, Switzerland. And if you look for news about this event, just about every headline you see has the word Trump in the title. The U.S. president's approach to trade and what people view as his protectionist positions run very counter to what so many of the attendees at this event tend to stand for. Yet there he is. And to see how others are responding to his presence and what we're learning at this event, we're going to go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
So the background, the important background to what's been going on at Davos is that earlier this week, the U.S. put tariffs on Chinese solar panels and washing machines. And then China, South Korea, they responded. I think South Korea may have been caught up in this as well, threatening retaliation. And so you've kind of got the world meeting with the specter of trade war looming overhead. People kind of thinking, well, are these the opening shots in a trade war? So with that background, then you have German Chancellor Angela Merkel get up to give her speech. And she gives a very strong condemnation of protectionism and an endorsement of open trade, of working together, etc. And of course, that is taken correctly as just almost a rebuke of Donald Trump, or at least a statement of opposition to Donald Trump. She also talked about how Europe needs to take more responsibility, about how Europe needs to take our destiny into our own hands, something she has said before, but reiterating that at that Davos summit. And so you're seeing her really put herself forward and put Germany forward in doing this as an alternative to the United States. You're saying we stand for we are a different power, we stand for a different way.
So we're getting this this message from the American president, basically says, look, America's back, we're open for business, this is a good place to invest, and he's trying to basically pitch this message that America does want trade, but he is drawing attention to some pretty serious imbalances that have been in place for quite some time. So it's quite something to hear this message coming from China and Germany countering that.
Right. And some of those imbalances, I think, are there genuinely because Germany and China's economy is being more efficient than the United States. But a lot of this is kind of portrayed as Donald Trump is starting a trade war, but China and Europe are the good guys here, and they're standing up for free trade, when the reality is quite different. In a lot of ways, Germany and China have been waging a trade war on America for years. China has been keeping the renminbi, its currency, artificially low for a long, long time. And what that does, that's basically an invisible tariff and an invisible subsidy on your exports. If the renminbi is artificially cheaper, it makes all of your goods artificially cheaper, and it makes it artificially more expensive for all of your people to use their currency to buy imports. It's unfair trade practices that's just a bit more disguised. The German disguise is even better. They're part of the euro, and just the presence of all of these weak economies in southern Europe naturally makes the euro much weaker than it would be if it were just the Deutschmark. So again, everything that they buy and sell basically has an invisible tariff, invisible subsidy. So they've been waging economic war in that way on the United States for years, and it has had serious damage on the United States. Donald Trump is now standing up and saying, well, I'm going to do something about it. And then China and Germany, because it was last year's Davos that it was China's Xi Jinping was there proclaiming himself as the leader of free trade. Now you've got Angela Merkel doing basically the same thing a year later. So I mean, really, it's audacious hypocrisy for these two leaders to turn around and do that. I mean, it's very smart, but that's not reality. But they're getting away with it, and they're getting away with it even within the United States. The United States media is right along there putting forward their narrative.
Sure. Well, looking at this from, we talk a lot about the importance of these grand movements within the world economy and just how much we're seeing power shift toward China and Germany in particular. Maybe you can just put what's happening at this summit in that context.
Right. When we talk a lot about China and Germany in particular regarding trade.
Yeah.
And the Bible has some very specific prophecies about a trading relationship between the two. And even that these two just build a whole trading system that excludes the United States. You know, a very detailed prophecy that talks about this trading system, who is in it. You can see other prophecies that talk about the United States being shut out of global trade. There are a load of prophecies talking about, you know, the European merchants and the merchants of this European power growing rich. So that's what we're seeing right now, is this system that excludes the United States being built. And that's what China, that's what Germany are talking about. And that's what this rhetoric is all about. It's the kind of the underpinnings of shutting America out of that system. It's something that that Mr. Brad McDonald wrote about in the April 2017 Trumpet edition. The article's called Trade Wars Have Begun. And that was based on just what we saw already with Donald Trump's presidency and the way the world reacted to that. We've seen it even more over the last few months. But that article is a great place to start to understand what the Bible prophesies about this, because it is a very important step in Bible prophecy. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes, and that's Trade Wars Have Begun.
Excellent. We appreciate that, Richard, very much. The status of Taiwan has long been disputed. Much of the world considers it a separate state, independent of China, but China says its government is illegitimate, that Taiwan is in fact part of China. And there are signs now that China is starting to push harder to exert its power over Taiwan. What is it doing, and why now? For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, in the last few weeks, China's really been ramping up its push against Taiwan in some interesting ways. On January 4th, China launched 4 new civilian airline routes right on the median line that separates Chinese airspace from Taiwanese airspace. And that was done without any prior consultation with Taiwan, and it violated a major agreement between China and Taiwan. It also violated basic global airspace treaties. And then China's also been increasing its military overflights of Taiwanese airspace. Fighter jets and bombers and surveillance aircraft have all been patrolling in Taiwan's airspace. So that shows that in a way, China just views that space basically as its own. And then China has also been applying economic pressure by limiting trade and tourism with Taiwan. They cut tourism by 30%, so that's a really heavy blow there. And then just last week, China's aircraft carrier sailed really menacingly through the Taiwan Straits. It didn't quite enter Taiwan's international waters, but it did enter its air defense identification zone. So this is it's just a really significant uptick in these kinds of Chinese pushes against Taiwan.
So why would China be doing this now?
Well, it looks like China's ramping up its aggression against Taiwan for a couple of different reasons. First, Beijing is worried that Taiwan's president, Tsai Ing-wen, will soon push for formal Taiwanese independence from China. Tsai was elected in 2016 on a platform of reversing all of the really conciliatory gestures that her predecessor had taken toward China. And she's been following through on that, taking a firmer stance toward Beijing. And then, you know, there's been a lot of pressure within her own government for her to push for formal independence. So the possibility of that seems to have China really concerned. And then the other reason why China's ramping up its push on Taiwan right now is just because Beijing thinks that the U.S. may not be willing to defend Taiwan anymore. Mm-hmm. Benny Avni is an Asia analyst, and on Tuesday he wrote about this intensifying Chinese push against Taiwan. And then he said, quote, "Is a military confrontation next? Will Beijing seek one as a pretext for invading and annexing Taiwan? Will America rush to the rescue? Our Asian allies are increasingly skeptical. Asian confidence in America is eroding." Mm-hmm. End quote. So that's the feeling that many analysts in China and in Taiwan and elsewhere have. just that America's security assurances are very much in doubt. And because of that, it may be time for China to make a move on Taiwan.
So I think it was, 1997 that Gerald Flory wrote an article where he was talking about exactly this happening. So 20 years ago, maybe?
Yes, actually, it was 98. And that was right after President Bill Clinton had made some statements that basically publicly opposed Taiwanese independence. And so at that time, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory said that President Clinton's stance meant that it was only a matter of time before Taiwan would come under China's rule. He wrote an article called Taiwan Betrayal, and one quote from that said, "The people of Taiwan feel betrayed. Once again, America has showcased its broken will to the whole world. How could anyone fail to see that Taiwan is destined to become a part of mainland China? They're going to be forced into the Chinese mold, and it's going to happen for one reason, because of a pitifully weak-willed America." Hmm. So at the time that was written, it would have seemed like that, you know, absorption of Taiwan into China could have only taken place in the very distant future. But right now, though, as we see Chinese power growing and its willingness to use that power growing, and as we see America's security assurances increasingly in doubt, it's very easy to see how Mr. Flurry's assessment there could happen quickly. And this would be perfectly in line with what Richard mentioned in the last segment, which is, you know, what the Bible says in Isaiah 22 and 23 about China becoming powerful and aggressive in the end time and coming to be one of the main powers that dominates world trade at the expense of America. So we have a booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy, which goes through those and numerous other Bible prophecies about end time Asia. And there's a whole section in that booklet specifically about Taiwan and how it will be grafted back into China very soon. So we'll have a link to that booklet in the show notes.
Excellent. We appreciate that. Go check those out and read that article, Taiwan Betrayal. We appreciate the quoting from that. That's really fascinating. Serious unrest is also seizing the African nation of Ethiopia, to the point that Foreign Policy wrote an article titled Ethiopia is Falling Apart. At the Trumpet, we have highlighted biblical prophecies showing that we are going to see a dramatic change in this country. To learn more about this, we'll go back to Anthony Chibadewe.
When you compare Ethiopia with other nations in the so-called Horn of Africa region, it's relatively stable, or it has been relatively stable if you compare it to the likes of Somalia. But things have been changing over the years. And here's just one development that's just part of a much bigger trend that we've been watching in the past few years. Last weekend, on January 20th, Ethiopian security forces shot and killed seven protesters who were singing anti-government songs. Human rights activists say that the number of those killed was much more than just seven. But at any rate, these people were at some sort of a Christian festival, and they started singing these anti-government songs, and at least seven of them were killed. It's a big disaster anywhere, but it's a particularly bigger disaster here in Ethiopia, because it's a country that has a lot of ethnic divisions, and a lot of the recent tension that we've been seeing has a lot to do with that. I can just go through some of those. Back in October 2016, at some festival by this Oromo ethnic group, there was anti-government tension there, and then 700 people ended up being killed because of the violence that erupted. The government declared a state of emergency for about 6 months, and then after those 6 months, they extended it by four more months. Another incident, October last year, 10 people were killed over food shortages. They were protesting against food shortages, and when the government clamped down on those protests and some people were killed, more people started protesting against that. December last year, the military killed about 15 people. So we're seeing a lot of these, a lot more unrest in Ethiopia. There's an organization called the Fund for Peace, which produces an annual report, which predicts states that are in danger of failure. And Ethiopia, it used to be on number 24 on that list of nations that are at risk of failing, and now it's number 15. So we're seeing a lot of tension. That's a lot of tension, and we expect that because the Bible does indicate that Ethiopia is going to change. Right now, it's fairly stable. It has been fairly stable, but we expect that it's going to become a lot more radical because the Bible mentions Ethiopia by name, particularly in Daniel 11, verse 43, where he talks about Ethiopia being aligned with this radical Islamic power that's led by Iran. And already Iran has a strong influence in Ethiopia's neighbors like Somalia, Eritrea, and even across the Red Sea in Yemen. And we're seeing Iran exerting a little bit more of its influence and taking advantage of the situation. And that's what we expect because of Bible prophecy. If our readers want to know more about this and our listeners, they can go to thetrumpet.com and read Libya and Ethiopia in Prophecy. Specifically, there's a chapter called Ethiopia on the Brink. It's the last chapter in the booklet. That booklet, again, is Libya and Ethiopia in Prophecy.
Fantastic. Thank you for that, Anthony. We'll finish with an economic story out of the United States. The Census Bureau produces a poverty measure, and it just revealed that by this reckoning, the poorest state in America is not Mississippi, it's not Arkansas, it's California. What is it that's made California so poor? For the answer, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this was brought out in a CityLab report this week that actually, even though California has one of the highest GDPs among the states, almost one in five people there is below the poverty line, or specifically below their adjusted poverty line. The nation produces a nationwide poverty line that doesn't account for differences in cost and living between places like Arkansas and California. But as anyone who's visited California will know, food and housing and other things are more expensive there. So according to this adjusted metric, seeing that what can you actually purchase with your money, 20.4% of Californians live below that line, which is interesting because obviously poverty in America is quite a bit better than poverty in a lot of other nations. I guess to give a sense, they said for a single mother with two children renting an apartment in San Francisco, she'd have to be making less than $29,000 to count as below that poverty line, which is a lot compared to other parts of the world, but still not much to get by in California. Mm-hmm. And this CityLab report looked into some of the data and showed that back in the 1990s, when the Republican Congress and under the President Bill Clinton's administration, they signed some welfare reform policies that made it so people couldn't be on welfare for more than 5 years, and they couldn't be on for more than 2 years unless they were looking for a job, and some other things like that to just try to encourage people to get off those welfare rolls. And a lot of states followed suit. California didn't follow suit. They kept up with a lot of the no strings attached cashed handouts, and kept raising their minimum wage up all the way to like $10, and now even moving up closer towards $15 by 2022. And the stats are in, and it showed that giving people money without any strings attached to it and raising the minimum wage doesn't really incentivize or make it easier for people to get out and find jobs. And now they have a worse poverty problem than anywhere in the nation. Mm-hmm. And we'll have an article going up on a website soon, kind of breaking this down a little bit more into what the Bible has to say about poverty and welfare and what God says is permissible and what God says is not. But it's definitely... in accordance to, even the fourth commandment itself says, 6 days shall you labor and do all your work, the seventh day you rest. And so just like you rest the seventh day, you're also expected to work the rest of the time. And when you, the Apostle Paul said that he will not, who will not work shall not eat. And so you are breaking biblical laws when you give able-bodied people money who refuse to work for it. Mm-hmm. And you break those laws, it has, it is going to have curses, like this curse on California. So we will have an article up on the website breaking down California's case specifically. And then also in the show notes, we'll put the article you wrote a couple years back on the welfare system that works, that breaks down the not California specific situation, but just the more general, what does the Bible say about welfare?
Very inspiring subject when you look into it. Well, we appreciate that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour on thetrumpet.com. We will provide links to all the articles and the literature that we discussed on the program today. You can let us know what you thought of the program by emailing letters at thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chibadewe, and Richard Palmer.
You're welcome.
Pleasure to be with you.
And thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Washington Irving. Great minds have purposes. Others have wishes. Little minds are tamed and subdued by misfortune, but great minds rise above them. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.